And be sure to visit PopCultureNetwork.com for more episodes of Fans of Power. And now, Pop Culture Network presents Fans of Power Episode 82 with Tyler T-Rex Baker and Joe the Tomato Amato.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to a very, very special episode of Fans of Power. Our guest today is somebody that has been in most of our lives. If you're listening to this show, you know who this man is in some form or fashion, but we're talking to somebody who's had bar fights with Patrick Swayze in the movie Roadhouse, crossed swords with David Carradine, and he has sang solos to Bruce Willis. He's done so many wonderful things, and but today, particularly, he's here as Anthony DeLongis, the man who portrayed Blade in the live-action He-Man movie. So, Anthony, thank you so much for greeting us with your time.
Well, you're welcome. You're basically describing somebody who can't keep a job by the sound of it.
Well, just showing some of the fun highlights of your illustrious career. I mean, expand on that, but just as a brief introduction, because I'm sure a lot of people have seen Roadhouse and certainly have to recognize your face from that movie.
I hope so. I'm bad at my phone here. Hopefully I'm trying to make sure I don't run out of battery. But ain't technology grand.
It is.
Okay, so what can I tell you?
Okay, well, I guess to start out with, before we kind of get to your work on the He-Man film, just kind of give our listeners and viewers an idea of what you do and how you got into the career of fight choreographer and weapons specialist.
Well, I started as an actor. I started at the Old Globe Theater in San Diego, and I went down as a journeyman. I'm not sure if they still do it this way or not, but it's one of the ways that you work towards getting your equity card and, being a professional theater actor. And so I was basically, I was literally a spear carrier in places. And then San Diego, you're working two plays. You rehearse two plays, open two plays, run them in repertory while you're rehearsing the third play, and then you open that, and then you run all three for a total of about 5 months. And the third play that they did was, I got to play Edgar in King Lear. They read the company, and as it happened, Mark Singer was going to play the role, and then he had another opportunity, and so that part opened up, and I won. And so, for two of the plays, I was, kind of being, helpful and in the background, and as is necessary, because it takes a lot of help to do plays, to do movies, etc. So that was a good lesson. But then in the third one, I was up there and had quite a part. And from there, they saw me. They had representatives from the Amundsen Theater who were coming down. They were going to mount a production of Cyrano de Bergerac with Richard Chamberlain. And they came down. They saw my work. They asked me to read, which I did, and then they also saw some of my choreography, and they asked me to, do the choreography, the duel and rhyme, which essentially gives Cyrano his credibility. If that opening scene doesn't work, then the play isn't nearly as effective. So it became, that's where my parallel career started. So in front of the camera or, on stage, I was working as an actor. I got to play Iago twice in Othello, which is still one of the greatest roles I've ever had the chance to embrace. But then I also started doing weapons choreography. And my first martial art was European fencing. My fencing master, I went out for it in college. I thought this is a good thing for an actor to know, and I wasn't very comfortable in my physical persona, which isn't a good thing for an actor because your whole body, your voice, your mind, your heart and spirit, and of course then your physical, abilities inform your choices and can give great credibility to your characters or not if you don't develop those skills. So I started to develop those skills. And the long and the short of it was I got my equity card and came back the next year as part of the equity company at the Old Globe. And then I started doing more I went from fencing. I trained with Ralph Faulkner, who was a two-time Olympian and Swordmaster to the Stars, for about 15 years. Then I started doing Taekwondo and went to a red belt level. Then I trained with Guru Dan Inosanto. He's the second really great teacher in my life. Both he and Ralph Faulkner really informed the work that I do, especially the work that I do with the bullwhip, with the system I created, and so on. And currently I'm training in Shinkendo, which is Japanese swordplay under Kaizo Toshishiro Obata and my sensei, who is Matthew Lynch. So for my mind, you never stop learning, you never stop getting better. And then it... well, it gives me a lot more choices in the roles I play. And then, you know, in the choreography that I do, I've staged action for all the big theaters in Los Angeles, also in San Diego and as far north as San Francisco and over into Arizona. And then in film and television, some of my best roles, like Pietro the Assassin in MacGyver, or, you know, of course, in Roadhouse, playing a character called Ketchum, which was a whole lot of fun. And they flew me to Shanghai to partner Jet Li in Fearless. I guest starred twice on Highlander, the series, and co-choreographed my sword action both times with my friend Braun McCash, who was the series swordmaster. So all of these things give me more choices. And then I specialize in training other actors to make the most of their character action opportunities. For example, in Masters of the Universe, I trained Dolph Lundgren with the sword. You know, I also trained Harrison Ford with the bullwhip for his return in Crystal Skull. I trained Michelle Pfeiffer as Catwoman, Angelica Houston, Ellen Barkin, the whip fighters in The Rundown, and a long list of things. So, and then people come from all over the country, all over the world, to train with us here at Rancho Indalo. They also do an action vacation for people who want to train to be their favorite superhero.
So that's a common thing, then, that people, when they come out to your ranch, you know, you've been watching Conan the Destroyer or the Beastmaster, and you're like, okay, we can you know, make that, you know, come to fruition.
Oh, absolutely. It's funny you mentioned that. I ran the Conan show at Universal Studios for the last 3 years. I got to come in and retrain everybody and then re-choreograph the show. So that has a place in my heart. I got to work some wonderfully talented people, and it was a very, very popular show. And but yeah, it's like, you know, who do you want to be? What do you want to learn? I teach all the bladed weapons that I study. I've been studying bladed weapons for over 4 decades. I do the European weapons, broadsword, longsword, saber, rapier and dagger, small sword. I do the Filipino weapons, thanks to my work with Gordon and Asanto. So the Filipino double weapons and, you know, sticks and knives. And then I also do Japanese, you know, katana and spear and staff, etc. So it's, and the longer I study, the more I recognize the fundamental truths and structures that connect the arts. There's weapon specific adjustments that maximize the effectiveness of each tool or that reference a particular culture, but what makes it combatively viable, there are universal principles and structures. So the more I study, the more I recognize the similarities in the other arts, and it allows me to move very quickly and easily from one to another. And when I'm teaching it, it allows me to, you know, point that out to students so that and with a little bit of training, I have a structure that I teach, which is all about skeletal alignment. And, you know, seeing the big picture, seeing what it is that makes this actually work combatively. So it's much easier to create the illusion of combat because you're actually telling the truth with everything except impact. And then with those structures, actors or students, or for that matter, martial artists, are able to make a weapon of opportunity out of virtually anything. And of course, you know, in film work, the absolute king of that is Jackie Chan. You know, he's one of the only people that you go, everybody else needs a script. You know, if Jackie walks into a room, I'm just looking and going, okay, what's he going to turn into a weapon here?
Now you had mentioned the Conan show at Universal. Is that how you managed to come in contact with director Gary Goddard by chance, or?
No, actually. Although Gary did do the Conan show, excuse me. Yeah, his company had put that together, and I thought it was a really cool show, and it went on for a while. And I happened to be up there visiting some performers I know, and I went and I watched the show, and I kind of did a little pitch and, you know, kind of said, I'd love to talk with you about, you know, working with you on your show, because as often happens after a show has been on for a while, some of the magic that, you know, made it special initially, it gets a little blurred. And they had a variety of people coming in of, you know, to train the new teams, et cetera. And sword work is a passion. There's not a lot of money in it usually. I mean, every once in a while, a picture will come along like Pirates of the Caribbean or something. You know, and you know, a couple people will get a job. But for the most part, you do swords because you love it. And then sometimes you're able to turn it into something like, you know, my adventure with Jet Li and in Shanghai on Fearless. You know, if I hadn't had my 35 plus years at that point of sword work, I wouldn't have been able to, you know, work at his level. And the two of us virtually created that action sequence on the spot. There was no rehearsal. Wow. But I'll tell you that story later if you like. But it's yeah.
Okay. Well, I guess then, essentially, how did you get approached with the He-Man?
Oh, movie? You were talking about Gary. Sorry. When you scratch these things, memories come flooding back, and I just went.
Oh, it's good hearing all this stuff because you've done so much. So.
What was that?
I said you've done so much, so it's good to hear all these stories from, you know, from your professional career.
Most of them, and accurately too. So that's a good thing. no, it's just I don't remember how I had the opportunity to read for it. I was probably recommended as both an actor and then someone, you know, the character was Blade, the double swordsman. And I went, well, as it happens, at that point, I don't know, I'd probably had 20 years of, you know, working with a variety of different bladed weapons and martial arts. So I got to go in and read, and Gary must have liked what he saw because I pretty much. You know, he was asking me, you know, to shave my head or I'll spend, you know, two and a half hours in makeup every day. And, you know, we were talking about being on the film. So, you know, I took a flyer. I remember Meg Foster was in the trailer, too. And she went, yeah, you know, she applauded my bravery for going with the shave the head option. So, but yeah, it's funny because we were at a screening a couple of years ago for Masters of the Universe. I hadn't seen it in quite a while, and the actress who played Tila was there, and, you know, he says, recount your stories, and I guess she came back a bunch of times to keep reading. You know, she said, you made me read for this like 8 times or something, you know, and of course she did a terrific job, and, you know, he obviously made the right choice. But I was kind of going, I really don't have a story like that to tell. I vaguely remember reading, and then not too long after that, I was in the makeup trailer, and we were starting to train Dolph, and coordinator was Walter Scott, you know, terrific coordinator, old school. I worked for him a bunch of times since then. But, I, you know, I was coming in as an actor, and Lauren Jane's a very famous stuntman who actually did a little bit of choreography for up at or a little fight training for the Conan show. We worked together on MacGyver, the first season. I was Pietro the Assassin, and, you know, he looked at me and he said, "You know more about swords than I do. You trained Dolph." I went, "Okay, sounds good to me." So I ended up training Dolph, which was fun, and we trained, you know, fairly intensively for about a month, and then I didn't see him for almost a month because he was busy shooting scenes that I wasn't involved with, and he was too busy to do much training. I think we may have had one or two sessions, you know, at his hotel or whatever in that interim. And then all of us, you know, and I'm saying to Walter, when can I take a look at the location and, you know, start showing you some ideas for the fights? And he's like, ah, don't worry about it. You know, you'll have plenty of time when we get down there. Well, we got down there, and what do you think was the first thing we shot? Yes, I had about an hour. And I grabbed off, and I remember that stuff that I taught you, you know, a month ago, and da, 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 and we threw this fight together in literally about an hour, which I'm going like, oh, it's good, but it would have been better if we'd had more time. But, you know, that throughout my career and pretty much everyone else's, time is a luxury you almost never have.
Now, I guess, essentially, were you planning to have a much larger fight based on the training that you and Dolph had done before, like the fight that we get in the movie? I mean, it's a fantastic, it's one of my favorite scenes in the movie, but based on what you were...
I've waited a long time for this.
Yes. I meant to introduce the show like that, too. I can't believe I forgot that, too.
Man. Yeah, don't worry.
But of course,
I would have liked the longer fight. You always like a longer fight. You know, you always like more time. You always like more opportunity to, you know, say more things. But it was one of those cases where we were shooting at night. We had a finite amount of hours. We were in a location that we only had for a little while. And this was only part of that evening shoot. So it was just like, oh, you know, we had all this stuff with and he actually picked up the Sorad double and threw him into my chest from, you know.
So you really took the bump, you know, on that.
Oh, yeah. No, I went, so I guess I'm catching him, am I? So I let him bounce off me, and then I, you know, went to the floor. But the costume for me was not very user friendly. There's a story there. Have you ever heard it?
No.
Well, I'm in surgical rubber from head to foot, and initially my arms were covered too. Fortunately, they uncovered those. But then I had gauntlets.
The material that you have on your legs and underneath the chainmail as well. Okay, because I've often wondered what that was you were wearing, like.
It was surgical rubber. It was lined, fortunately. But basically, I'm wearing a wetsuit. And then I've got boots. And then I've got gauntlets and gloves. And then I've got chain mail, which we'll come back to in a minute. And then I've got these sort of football pads with spikes so that I've got to be careful when I turn my head that I don't poke my eye out. And, you know, as soon as they put that on me, I went, well, so much for shoulder rolls in this outfit. And then I've got the headgear. That, you know, they would glue to my head, which got interesting as, you know, whenever we were doing a lot of action, because, you know, you perspire. And so they're constantly re-gluing the attachments to your head. But the chain mail, that was a treat, because it, they never would tell me how much it weighed, but it was 10 6-foot lengths of pipe cut into 1/4-inch pieces. So basically I was wearing about 50 feet of pipe, which was very heavy.
I certainly say so.
Shoulders, and then they put the other thing over. And when, you know, when we would take breaks, I usually would stay sort of half suited up, and not get out of everything until the end of the day. But many was the day that I would take an up into my boot and, you know, well over a pint of water would come pouring out of my boots. I expected fish to come out. Yeah, well, it's just, you know, you sweat and you're in rubber and it's got no place to go except the bottom of your feet, you know, your booties. And so I used to get a, you know, kind of a kick out of it, but I'm also kind of going, it's a good thing I stayed hydrated.
Now,
real quick, Tyler.
Oh, no, go ahead, Joe. Go ahead, Joe.
Oh, I had a question. I mean, obviously, you know, we know you're a master of weapons in real life, and obviously what a perfect role for you to be playing for this. Now, we also seen in the movie that you use a laser whip, and we didn't get to see a real whip. Now, was there ever a thought, did you ever suggest using a real whip? Because I know you have great control. I mean, people have probably seen your videos before. Was a real whip ever thought or brought up, or did they just not want to go with that at all?
Well, remember, at the time, I'm the actor. So the actor really doesn't get a lot of input. And what they told me was, here's this handle, and they gave me this thing that was about, 12, 13 inches long, you know, and said, we're going to animate this laser plasma whip. And I went, okay, you know, I actually can do the whip. I'm very good at it. Excuse me. And Sorry, I've got a bit of a cold.
Oh, you're fine.
From the folks that were here, little petri dishes. But so I said, well, look, if you're going to animate this, in other words, this was a decision that was above my pay grade. They didn't ask me. They didn't really, it was never a consideration of what I might or might not be able to do. They were going to do this as an animation, as one of their cool special effects. And I said, well, okay, if you're going to do that, at least let me show you how a whip actually works. So I persuaded them to actually take some footage of me using the whip. And the body language that you see me doing is the way I throw a whip, or at least that's how I threw a whip in those days. I'm better now. Because if I look at it this way, if I'm not getting better, I'm just getting older, and there's only one of those I can do anything about. So I keep, that's why I never stop training. I keep trying to get better. But anyway, I got them to take a film of me doing that, and then the animators studied that, and I think it helped make the scene more effective, and I think it made the animation look a lot better.
Okay. Yeah, I was always curious about it because, I was almost under the assumption that maybe it was your idea for the whipping scene just because you are, a master of the whip. I almost wonder, I was like, did Anthony tell them, hey, whipping would be a good idea for this? But I guess they already had it planned then, huh?
They did. That was fast forward a few years and I get this call. Would you like to come in and, teach Michelle Pfeiffer how to crack a whip? And would you like to come in and audition for the director and Michelle Pfeiffer? And I went, yes, I would. And this was a coordinator named Max Clevin. And, Max had me come in and I showed him. I said, okay, well, here's what I do with the whip. And we were in this like little patch of grass outside of, one of the bungalows at over at, pretty sure it was Warner Brothers. And he went and he immediately took me over to meet Tim Burton and Michelle Pfeiffer, who was there for a screen test in her wardrobe, one of her first ones. And there was some talk about, a cat of nine tails. And I said, don't use a cat of nine tails because basically it has all kinds of baggage. It's a punishment whip. It's the sort of thing that, they used to beat seamen with in the British Navy. It's the sort of thing that the Inquisition used to use. It's a torture device. And all you can do is hit things. It's, it's what they call a flogger, and then stand there and pose, and it's very SME, and you're just kind of going, and I said, the whip is actually the first man-made tool to break the sound barrier, it is an extraordinarily versatile weapon from both long, medium, and close range, and so I showed them what I could do, and fortunately, they went, yeah, that's what we want. And so I got to train Michelle. I trained her for 6 weeks, about three times a week. And then I continued to train her throughout filming, which was great. But I got that little jump on her because they were shooting out Danny DeVito scenes for the most part. And Michelle saw what I was trying to give her, which was another vocabulary for her character. And it grounded her, it lowered her center of gravity, and because she was working in between 3 and 5 inch heels all the time, no small thing. And the whip got her utilizing her entire body for everything she was doing, which was enormously sensual, but also very, very powerful. And I was trying to do, let's take something that is inherently alluring but dangerous, and it's hypnotic like a cat. But it has that same quality of, a tiger or a panther, it's like, don't mess with me. So it gave her tremendous credibility because that's all her. She had Trish Peters, who's a world-class gymnast, doing her high falls and stuff. And she had Kathy Long, who was 5-time world kickboxing champion. She's doing her fights. Now, Michelle did all of her own. She did all her fights. It's just there are a couple of inserts of some very powerful kicks from Kathy Long. But with the whip, none of the pro stunt girls got anywhere near her ability. She rocked. And we were actually able to create on set the Ice Princess scene. I don't know if you remember that, the Penguin captures the Ice Princess. Yeah. She's in the chair. Batman comes in and suddenly, suddenly she appears and, cuts her free and throws the chair and cracks a whip and says a line and they leave. And Tim, fortunately, very early on, there was one day I wasn't there, and Michelle had a little problem with the whip, and she said, I want Anthony on set whenever I work, which was great for me, because I could look and go, guys, can you move that light just, you know, 6 inches? Because if I gave her a 14-inch path, she could work and, you know, focus on her performance. So I was there to help make sure that little problems didn't turn into big problems. And also, we'd walk onto a set and go, all right, we've got all of this clutter, so let's work in. We'll stay in the diagonal and horizontal quadrants. Or, oh, you know, there's crap everywhere on the sides, so we'll work in the verticals. And we would actually turn, you know, adversity into opportunity. But in this instance, you know, I walked on the set, and Tim Burton says, I don't think there's any whip stuff today, Anthony. I went, yes, sir. And I sat over in a corner, and I watched them go through the scene. And when they were done with kind of a walkthrough, because I had this kind of relationship with Michelle, I said, you know, if a chair in one hand and a whip in the other says lion tamer the world over, no matter what language you speak, you know, if you were to swing it, and she goes, Anthony has this idea. And what she ended up doing was she swung it on her whip, slashed the girl free, dumped her out of the chair, cracked the whip through the chair, wrapped the girl around the waist, pulled her in for a two-shot to say her line, girl talk. And we rehearsed it twice and shot it, and we were done. But we created it on the spot because she had that vocabulary. She was that good. I'm a huge believer in, well, I show up already trained, and that's another story. But, you know, when I'm helping other people, you know, for God's sake, train the actors, give them that credibility because it's priceless. And the audience can really identify with a performer when they see their character actually doing it. So we reaped rewards big time with her on that.
Still my favorite. She stole the show and the movie because of that. So
what's that?
I said, I mean, she stole the show and all those the scenes where she's cracking up, and that particular scene right there, I mean, it's a very memorable scene from the movie too. So your work really just brought out the best in her.
As far as I'm concerned, she's the best thing in the picture. Although Michael Keaton did a good job, too.
Oh, he's my favorite Batman. now, I guess, yeah, and I know that when you like to approach characters, and you do such a great job of playing villains, and I almost say you might
play villains. Enjoy. I play heroes. I
play heroes.
Make their own rules.
Yes. Well, no. How did you approach Blade then? You know, since you're looking for, especially engaging in the sword fights and how you're maneuvering around, because there's so many things that you do throughout the film. I was telling Joe about this the other day, like these small gestures, these facial expressions you make that it's like, it almost feels like, or did you do any kind of improv with your character throughout the, you know, like there's a scene when Dolph surrenders the power sword and you kind of kneel down and you're examining the sword and you stand up and you have this big smile on your face and kind of like clench it, like we've got it, we won. Just as an example of the things that you did, is that what you came up with? Was that instructed to do with the character, or what did you bring to the character of Blade based on what was in the script?
Thanks for that. None of that was in the script. I knew Gary was pointing the camera at me. I just stayed in character, the character that I'd created. So all of those were little found moments, that, you know, Gary didn't tell me to do it, but he didn't tell me not to do it. And he seemed to like it because they're in the movie. So
it's awesome because the malice you convey, you know, given, you know, your character does speak quite a bit, but there are so many times where you don't say anything. It's just like in the Grayskull throne room when you turn towards camera holding the power sword, mm-hmm. and you're looking at Christina Pickles, the sorceress, mm-hmm. and you kind of throw the sword at her in a mocking manner with this very villainous smile on your face, not saying a word, but it's mocking the heroes in the scene. Like, this is just such great acting on your part, adding to the character.
I really appreciate that because, yeah, those were all things that I was doing in the hopes that it was helping make the story better, which is, you know, it's what every actor does. I think I owe a lot of that to my stage background because And I learned this early in my career, which is a valuable lesson. It's nice if they give you lines, but you don't have to say anything if you're in the scene. And then, you know, actors often say if you're present in the scene or whatever, but basically it means you're in character. Because if you're in a scene, the audience is looking to see, what does he think about this? I know what that guy thinks because he's talking, but what does Blade think about all this? You know? So I, you know, had my response. See, the one thing, and none of this was in the script, and I'd never really seen the cartoon show, and I gathered the character of Blade wasn't there either. So there wasn't a whole lot of backstory to play with, so I kind of created my own, one of which was I always figured He-Man gave me the eye. You know, the thing, the eye patch that I wore and everything. Which is a funny little aside. I'll tell you that in a minute. But that I always figured that was what informed the line, I've waited a long time for this, you know, to get my revenge for what you did to me. So that was just an assumption I made. And, you know, Gary seemed to like what I was doing because he almost, I remember very little specific direction from him other than, you know, setting the scene and you're in and, you know, and we'd look at the environment or whatever. And I would make decisions. There was not a lot of rehearsal. There was no, you know, no weeks of rehearsal and improv and, you know, and any of that. It was, we were moving too fast. I didn't find out until actually years after the movie had come out, what a balancing act Gary was doing with producers, that we apparently ran out of money, excuse me, several times, you know, where, you know, they couldn't make payroll. And it's just like, well, Gary told this story at the last screening. He says, yeah, you know, he says, well, we're all here. How about if, you know, we just work today and we'll make sure we have the money for you by the end of the day. And they did, and he did somehow. So it was, but the performers, we weren't aware of any of that. So that's really, you know, a kudos to Gary for managing to keep all of us creative and keep the production moving forward in spite of, you know, the hurdles. He was, you know, he couldn't just focus on making the movie. He also had to focus on financing the movie on a daily basis.
And I was curious about that. If you and the rest of the cast, you know, are you there when you have executives from Canon showing up and causing turmoil behind, you know, during, in between takes?
Very smart. We weren't aware of that. And that's probably to do, I would say, hopefully some of it was the, you know, the fact that, you know, the location manager producer was smart, and hopefully, you know, and I think a lot of it was Gary. None of that took place in front of the actors. So, you know, the actors could stay focused on what we were trying to create. It really doesn't belong in front of the actors because we're very insecure. So, you don't need the distraction. So, but yeah, I tip my hat to Gary for managing to juggle both, you know, the creative demands of what was essentially a huge shoot while also, you know, dealing with the difficulties of producing and directing.
Well, and to me, finding that out as an adult, you know, I've done so much research for the film over the years and learning of the problems that Canon was going through and that, you know, this particular picture was facing troubles all the time from budgetary reasons, telling, you know, we're going to stop filming here, or you can't shoot that, we got to cut it smaller. It just makes you appreciate what's on screen even more. Because, I mean, I loved it as a child. To me, it was flawless. And as I got older, it was like fine wine. It just got better and better. I would notice details a lot more, like much like the things you've done throughout the movie that as a kid I didn't notice. I just saw you as, and to me as a kid, you were the first cool bad guy. Like as a kid, I was always praising the heroes, but as a kid, I like, that is the coolest bad guy. The patch, the sword play, the gauntlet darts, everything. You were my first. I'm like, that's a really cool bad guy.
Well, thank you. Well, as it turns out, I'm perhaps aligned with the wrong party, but you know, I I never, most bad guys don't think of themselves as bad guys. You know, I love playing, well, a strong antagonist, because if the hero doesn't have a strong antagonist who really pushes him, then he doesn't have to dig deep and rise to the occasion. You know, it's a foregone conclusion. And you don't get the suspense. You don't get the audience, you know, as emotionally invested and rooting for him to, you know, come on, Rocky, get up, you know, or, you know, however you want to think of it in those terms. But it's so I've always enjoyed playing the bad guys who don't, you know, bad guys are human beings too. You know, they love their families. They pet their dog. You know, they do, you know, you want to be a bad guy, kick a dog, you know, and then everybody's going to hate you. But, you know, I've always looked for a piece of humanity, you know, in any characters that I played who were the antagonists. And I've gotten to play a few, and hopefully there's a few more in my future. But I look for the humanity about them, because you can't identify with a stereotype. If somebody is indeed doing the wrong thing, you want the audience to believe that, well, geez, maybe if I had gone through the same thing that he has, maybe I'd be that way too. Or, you know, you look for something that they can identify you with, and it gives you dimension, and it makes you a human being as opposed to a caricature. So, but that being said, I always, if I've got substance to the character I've created, then I always try to look to add a little style. But it's always on top of substance, not instead of substance. I don't twirl my swords unnecessarily.
Gotcha. Mustache. Now, you, I mean, it certainly shows, because every scene that you're in, you really present yourself as you are like the best of the best. Like, as far as a mercenary, evil warrior, bounty hunter, your facial expressions, how you pose with the sword, it's like you've done it. So, like, you present the characters like, this is the most experienced swordsman, you know, in this film, or in like the universe, in the world of Eternia. Just with your mannerisms, I mean, the spinning of the swords. And that you hold yourself to I mean, like, you're almost like a very cocky villain, you know. Is that something you said
almost like,
or is that just how I'm viewing it?
You broke up. You said you're almost like a very what? And then
cocky villain, very sure of yourself,
confident.
Yes, that's an even better word, confident. Yes.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that seemed to be the character. You know, we were, you know, the curious quartet, that we were each the best. You know, we were selected by Evil-Lyn, you know, the power behind the throne. And so I looked at myself in that way. And, you know, and as the double swordsman, and that I'm wearing physical scars, but that I'm a survivor, and that, you know, you... when you need to get it done, you call me. And so that was fun to play. Couple little things that you might, I don't know, you may or may not know, but you're being so complimentary, so I'll share them with you. First was the eye patch. All of this was being thrown together, you know, kind of in pieces. We go out to the shop, and, you know, they take a casting of your head, you know, and we'd do stuff. And then they took a cast so that they could, you know, make the things on, you know, on that. And then they would fit, so that when I'd show up and make them, they could just put them on me. But I said, with the eye patch, it's like, I'm going to be fighting Dolph Lundgren, who, as far, you know, I nicknamed the power sword. He's essentially swinging a Buick. It's huge and it's heavy, and, you know, anybody with less athleticism than Dolph would not have been able to wield it, especially not as well. And I'm going, I need my depth perception. You're about to take away one of my eyes. I also said, please take the left, not the right, because I'm right eye dominant. But I also said, cut me some pin size holes in this. You know, it was essentially, it was black. It was opaque plastic. So I wouldn't have been able to see nothing. But by having them drill little tiny holes, for one thing, I got a little airflow, which helped. But I also had just enough vision to where I had depth perception, which when I'm fighting Dolph as Blade, and then later on when I'm fighting him as Frank Langella, was, you know, invaluable. There's another little sequence with Robert Duncan McNeil, you know, when we put the collar of truth on him, you know, in his kitchen when we come in with, you know,
yes,
man, and, you know, and Evil Lynn and stuff. I had these knives, and they were practical knives, you know, they were little sort of double-edged boot knives. And Gary said to me, scare him a little bit. And I went, okay. And I knew exactly where I was, and I knew exactly where he was, you know, and I've been doing this long enough to know I will keep you safe no matter what you do. And normally I wouldn't do something with an actor that we hadn't rehearsed, but he's sitting right there. So, you know, when I bury that knife next to beside his face, that wasn't rehearsed.
so all that was right there on the spot. I was going to ask you about that scene.
Yes, and I always appreciated Robert's trust. I worked for him later. We worked on Star Trek Voyager. I was Maj Kulla. Have you ever seen Star Trek Voyager?
Pieces of it, I have seen you on the show. Yes.
Yeah, well, I played a character called Maj Kulla. I actually had 5 guest starring roles. It was really cool. We hijacked, you know, Voyager and left them marooned for the end of one season, and then, you know, they got it back to start out the next season, and it was a fun character to play. And Robert was, you know, playing, I think he was the pilot, you know? So he had a recurring, you know, character there. So our paths crossed again, and then some years later, he became the producer of a show called Chuck. And so we worked together again on that. I came in as a villain at one point on that, so that was a lot of fun.
You know, one other question. You know, speaking of Skeletor, how far into the movie did you find out that you were going to be playing basically God Skeletor to fight He-Man? You know, was that a surprise, a shock to you, or did you know that pretty early on?
No, that was a shock, and it happened, I think, in the last week of filming, as I recall. It just became, you know, Frank. Frank was either too busy or disinclined to do a lot of fight rehearsal. Not that we ever had a lot of fight rehearsal, but Walter said, "You're going to double. You're going to double Frank Langella." And I went, "Yes, sir." And I was happy to have the opportunity, and of course, it made it easier for Dolph. Because again, it was another one of these cases where we have, like, you know, the day before we're going to shoot this big, you know, this big sequence, which is the only sequence we're going to, there's a lot of juggling going on in terms of, we didn't have a lot of advanced schedule on what we were going to shoot and when, or at least I wasn't privy to it. I think there was a lot of things going on where there would be last minute changes and this and that. So the final stuff that we, you know, the final fight was really thrown together like the day before. And, you know, and the decision was made, well, you'll double him because you're going to be in all this makeup and that'll be fine. And I went, you know, happy to do it. And it'll be good because Dolph knows me and trusts me. And we're not having to worry about, you know, bringing an actor up to speed to be able to, you know. So basically I just did his, you know, physical dialogue for him during that sequence. So I enjoyed the opportunity. The only difficulty was, you know, I have the power staff and, you know, he has the sword. And I said, so this is how I'm going to be dressed, right? Like as Skeletor. So then I worked out a bunch of things that involved the staff coming in from a variety of angles, utilizing both ends of the staff and often with it swinging, you know, either around my body or over top of my head as it comes in from. You know, there's 8 angles of attack with every weapon, every bladed weapon. And so I was utilizing a variety of different angles, often going, you know, going over my head with one end of the staff or the other as I'm manipulating. So it would look a little bit more interesting than just going whack, 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 whack. And then we get to the set, which was, I think, the next day. And they went, oh, no, this is after the transformation. So I actually gave the, you know, the designer a little bit of crap about it at that screening a year ago. Said, so you're the guy, huh? Because as you may remember, I'm wearing a combination of the New York skyline and a set of elk horns all in gold, which meant all of the choreography that we'd done the day before, I couldn't do anymore. So I literally made something up, an hour before we're about to do it, and showed it to Dolph, and that's what we shot. So it was far from ideal, let's put it that way.
Yeah, because I figured that, gigantic helmet, that you had to wear, I didn't know how much awkward that would make the fight, wearing that compared to if you didn't think you were going to have that giant helmet.
Well, it was, yes, very awkward, very inhibiting physically, and made worse by the fact that there wasn't any time to go, okay, if I'm going to be wearing this, I will try to accommodate it in a more creative manner. I think I could have come up with some other additional elements if there had been more time. As it was, I think, what we did with it, is fine. It's effective. It works. But again, you're always looking to be, how creative. I always figure when I'm playing a character or when I'm, working as a fight coordinator, being on the other side of the camera, that I bring ideas to the director, the stunt coordinator, and say, do you like this or do you like this? That was how I worked when I was working with Michelle. And I had kind of an open conduit for that. In this instance, there just wasn't time. I've worked for Walter before, since then. I worked for him on, the TV series Magnificent Seven, and then I did all the flashback sword action for Secondhand Lions. And he would tell me, Secondhand Lions, they said, well, they want this to have this quality of memory, They want it to look like, because it's all in the kid's mind. And so they want it to look like Robin Hood or The Mark of Zorro or, that kind of 50s, Technicolor stuff. And I said, oh, well, I could do that. And so I would go off and make up choreography, that told that story, of their, deeds, daring deeds, rescuing princesses and fighting slavers, and in the Foreign Legion and this and that. But giving it with lots of flash and flair, like those old classic movies. And Walter would look at it and go, I don't like that moment. And I would make a small adjustment and we go to the director. And that's how I love to work. And it doesn't always work out that way. But, I appreciated his trust. I appreciated his confidence. And it allowed me to be very creative. But that was because we had already worked together a couple of times. And he went, I know the kid can do it. In this instance, we were scrambling, and we put together the best fight that we could. And fortunately, it was Dolph and I. It would have been more difficult if we were trying to get Frank to do this stuff. One of the things that was difficult, though, was I was wearing Frank's boots, which were a little too tight. Then they were leather-soled. Anytime I work in boots, which is all the time, I always have them put dance rubber. I have rubber heels and then dance rubber on the soles so that you have grip. But I'm in leather soles. And because of the smoke they're using, there's a film of oil on top of everything. So it's like an ice skating rink. Oh. And then when I got that, see in the Skeletor makeup, when the transformation goes back to Skeletor, I can see fine. There's a lot of makeup, but I can see. But in the helmet, I couldn't see. If you take and put your palm right up on the bridge of your nose, that's all I could see. I couldn't see the floor.
Oh, wow.
So basically, I'm looking through, a very, very narrow tunnel, like an eye slit on a tank. And I'm sliding all over the place. And then I'm facing Dolph, who's he's very controlled and very athletic, but he's also very exuberant and committed. So when he's swinging at you, he's swinging at you. So it was sort of like, there's so many things about this that aren't ideal, but failure's not an option. So we're going to do a good job. And I think we did.
Now, based on your lack of, vision because of the helmet and everything, is the fight sequence, is it pretty much like, you need to make sure you hit a mark at this point. And when you need to do an overhand, thrust or an uppercut or a slash above Dolph's head, like, is it just kind of counting beats, like 1, 2, 3? I mean, is that how you choreograph that particular fight or?
No, we always choreograph flow with the energy of your partner. Have you ever seen my Highlander, Duende, the fight in the rain in the Mysterious Circle? I was the first person to introduce that style of rapier fighting.
Okay.
But no, I like to respond to the energy of my partner. So basically, I'm going with the flow of the energy he's giving. Now, that being said, we had, you know, in the training, I said, these are the areas you will cut to. You know, you will cut vertically to my head. You will cut horizontally to my chest or belly, or horizontally to my shoulder or hip, you know, both inside and outside the weapon. Or you will cut diagonally, you know, on a downward diagonal or an upward diagonal. So we had very specific targets. So he was cutting for me, and then I was defending myself with matching skeletal aligned structures. And this is a system that I teach that gives you strength through structure rather than effort. So rather than, you know, fighting and taking all of his power, part of me is moving. And as you move out of the zone of power, the force of the hit lessens. And part of me is, the first thing I'm doing is creating a barrier that my body is behind. It's kind of like the force. My hand's behind my weapon, my elbow's behind my hand, my body's behind my elbow. If my body's behind my elbow, I have skeletal structural alignment. If it's not, you know, someone of Dolph's power will blow through my defense, and he'll either hit me or my own sword will be knocked into my face. So because we had trained together, we had a trust, so we had a commitment factor to where he could cut to target knowing that I would protect myself. So from that standpoint, no, it wasn't counted out. And, you know, we were, you know, he was cutting for my head and I was defending. I was going to try to decapitate him. And, you know, I am delivering with my body and making sure he's going to be out of the way. But if he hadn't moved, I could have stopped. But he did move, so I could finish the blow where his head had been a second before.
Well, that's a testament.
That's why you train, and that's why you rehearse.
That just makes it seem that much better. Now, I mean, no, specifically the lack of time that you guys had to rehearse and set up the fight.
Well, again, part of what made it work. Have you still got me? Did I just touch something I shouldn't have?
Oh no, you're still here.
Okay. Part of what makes it work is, how should we put this? It is the two of us working together and being sensitive to each other's energy. If Dolph hadn't had his previous training as an athlete and a kickboxer, and he'd just come off of doing, you know, Rocky and all that stuff. So he was in top shape and has really, really good skills. That made it a lot easier for me to add a couple things to his vocabulary, saying, okay, we're going to use your same skills, but we're now going to give you a tool, and it's going to be this sword. And here's how I'm going to protect myself. But we will have this when we are cutting specific targets. We are cutting with control, but commitment. And then, you know, we have a defense that is a structural alignment defense. So it will, you'll be able to, you know, make strikes of, you know, power, not lack of control, but power, you know, to that target and make it look good. So there was a commitment to both of us, but we were always very much connected and protecting each other. And that's how it should be.
Wow. It adds so many more layers that's one thing that's always fascinating me about movies is the fight scenes and how they're put together and knowing that all this is going on between the actors, you know, setting this up and everything that you're telling us, it makes you appreciate the craft so much more, that so much goes into this and just how good you two were with the little time you had, you put together something that, you know, all of us fans have continue and still do to this day. I mean,
my only regret is, had we had more time, I know we could have done more, but I'm very proud of what we did accomplish, especially against the so many odds that were against us, you know, that we, we both went, you know, failure's not an option. We're going to make this as good as we can, you know, and we gave Gary enough to be able to craft his story. The Skeletor fight was shot. The one with Dolph and I, even though we hadn't seen each other in a month, we had, you know, we had fought and flowed together, and I'd given him constructions that we were able to tap into and, you know, put together that nice, powerful, flowing fight. Earlier on, I waited a long time for this fight. The one with Skeletor at the end, there were fewer moves because Gary was trying to make up for, I think, our lack of time with style. So that was where he put in, you know, the silhouettes and the lights and the special, you know, the visual effects, you know, of the swords, you know, crashing together and stuff like that. So he was making stylistic, creative choices, you know, that we were then supporting with, you know, physicality. But it was a very different scene in both how it was shot and how it was constructed. Again, largely due, I think, to the fact that he did something very, very creative, you know, to overcome the fact that we didn't have a whole lot of time and pre-planning.
You know, speaking of that, if, like, let's say you did have more time, there was more budget, and you had a choice, would you have liked to had either more sword fights, things with whips, or other things like flails and maybe Eternian type nunchucks? Is there any things that you would have liked to see more if you had, you know, more say so?
Sure. Yeah, I hear they're going to make another one. Couple of people have said I'd make a good man at arms. It works for me.
Or hey, even Triclops. You could be Triclops. Yeah. Or heck, you could even reprise your role. Like, I guess that's another. That was one I was going to actually ask you is, you know, it would be great if you could return for a new Masters of the Universe movie. And if you had that choice, would you like to do a take on Triclops, or would you like to bring Blade back, you know, with more weapons, you know, being a master of weapons? What would you prefer?
I would be happy to be old Blade, but, you know, I would be happy to be part of the, because I've come to know the some of the fans and the, you know, the heart and the loyalty that's in the fans. So it would be, you know, a pleasure and a privilege to, you know, be able to come back and do more. But you know, anything they wanted to aim my way, I would try to make memorable. But yeah, it would be delightful to play Blade again or to play Man at Arms. I don't know too much about Triclops, but you know, whenever I do a role, I do as much homework as I can. You asked earlier about Blade. Much of what the choices I made were intuitive to the wardrobe, because you know, I looked at the wardrobe and go, why do I have this? You know, what does this do? Why is this important? You know, what can I do with this? And the way I drew my swords, or the way I put them away, or you know, the way I went after the girl when she was underneath the, you know, and stuff like that. You know, it's none of these were accidental. You know, I made decisions, you know, which to me were character-based decisions on everything I did. I always do, because to me, if I'm not, and here's my take on physicality. I love when I can combine a role that has both verbal and physical dialogue. The power of physical dialogue and action is visceral. You know, you can reach an audience on levels that it's very hard to reach them on if you just talk at them. But when you can combine the two together, that's I think that makes for a very powerful and intriguing character.
You know, that brings up another question I had. I was going to ask earlier, and it's a perfect thing you're saying. Is, you know, with all the mannerisms you did without even speaking at times, in the comic book adaptation of this movie, they had Blade as a mute, and I don't know if that was ever brought up, if that was going to be like his portrayal in the movie. Did they ever speak to you about Blade being a non-speaking character, or just from the get-go he was supposed to speak? Because in the comic book adaptation, he is a mute, and I just find that kind of interesting.
Did the comic book come before the movie or after?
I believe it was before. It certainly seems like the comic book was written based off the initial greenlit script, because there's certain scenes like He-Man's interacting with some local Earth children, Blade has a mouthpiece, and that's kind of how William Stout designed him initially, is that he has this mouthpiece over his mouth and apparently was not supposed to speak. And we were just kind of curious about that too, because he even has like a kind of like Wolverine claw, so it's a bit like a weapon on his right fist. And didn't know if all these changes were made before you came on board or
you. Well, I have no memory of anyone ever talking to me about any of that. So basically, they, from the sound of it, they cast me and turned me loose. And they apparently liked what I was doing, because they never said, stop that, or don't ever do that again.
I guess you were meant to do it then. It was like it was a perfect role for you. I mean, you were doing, in some ways, the non-speaking stuff without even trying, and without it ever being, I guess, told that that was going to happen, even though, you know, they never said it was going to. But it worked perfectly, because like you said, with not speaking, you can get so much across. And of course, then with, you know, your lines, is of course your classic line, you know, waited a long time for this. So much memorable stuff you've done for that movie, which makes you such a cult character in the Masters of the Universe community. So that's fantastic.
Well, you know, I can look to, I thank you very much. I appreciate that. I really do. You know, what you guys can do is help organize a groundswell of support to whoever it is who's doing the next movie. You know,
absolutely.
You know, maybe something could happen.
Well, believe it or not, me and Tyler, we've had that planned. We were going to have this planned, no matter what. If this movie is greenlit, we're going to do a campaign to try to get you back into the movie. And it would be great to see you as Blade, but in some form, we need to have you back for Masters of the Universe.
Works for me.
Because there's several villains in the mythology that are sword fighters. You've got Triclops, which is a bounty hunter who's a skilled sword fighter. Jitsu is a martial artist. Ninjor, Fisto, who is a hero who uses a broadsword. So it just seemed like to cast you as one, either a Blade again or one of these other new characters, and then you could work with, you know, actors who are possibly could portray some of these other villains who use, you know, various weapons that you're well acquainted with. It just seems like everybody wins. We get to see you, and you get to make these fights, you know, so much more elaborate and better.
I'd love it.
Your expertise. Yeah.
Well, I can make the fights mean something. I promise I never waggle my sword without, you know, purpose. And tell what I started to say a minute ago was, to me, if action doesn't drive story and articulate character and reveal, it's a disservice to the project and it's a disservice to the audience. The things should be done for a reason. And, well, quite frankly, the reason is the entertainment of the audience. You know, otherwise, it's just not emotionally evocative, and it doesn't, it doesn't service the project very well, and it certainly doesn't service the audience. So, you know, you see where I'm going with this. You know, when
I do, and certain fights didn't show that.
You know, bad antagonists make the hero have to work harder. You know, they make the hero assume some risk. So when he does ultimately triumph, you know, there has been some suspense, there's been jeopardy, and that's, I think, the two of the keys to a great fight. And then there is, you know, his ultimate triumph is then that much more rewarding, because he had to face a situation where he could quite potentially have lost, and lost everything. You know, and that's that gives an audience somebody to identify with. That's what makes a hero. If you know you're going to win going into the thing, then, you know, at best you're boring, and at worst you're a bully.
So you know what makes a great story, and I love that you have that sensibility about what makes a great story through a fight. And I look when I watch fight scenes, and like you said, you want the hero to be facing adversity and feel like, you know, it's a big challenge, it's a big mountain to climb here. And then when they do defeat the villain of this particular fight, whether it's through martial arts or a sword fight, a knife fight, whatever it may be, it just makes it that much more satisfying as the audience when, you know, they do triumph. And I really appreciate that you get it. And I wish you were choreographing all fights and working with them, because it feels like
Well, I'm trying to do it. I still enjoy that. I I'm always looking for a good role as an actor. I love being in front of the camera. That's how I've trained. But I think it's also what makes my choreography more effective, because I am trying to always tell a story. I am trying to always make the audience feel like they're part of the action and not just observing the action. And I'm always trying to make decisions that are, you know, character based and character driven. And then the dialogue, you know, the physical dialogue is what we're doing with the action. That, you know, that I'll often do. We've got a Highlander convention coming up in October. With my, did I lose you?
Nope, you're here.
Oh, we got
you. Oh, good. I suddenly have things flashing on the screen. Anyway, I've done this in live shows before. If I have a partner, we'll essentially have the audience direct the fight scene, and I'll say, okay, who's the good guy? Who's the bad guy? All right, what weapons do we have? And the audience will pick weapons, and then I'll say, all right, so who attacks first? Okay, so I attack, and my partner. They counter with one or an A choice or a B choice. So which do you like? Oh, B. Okay. So they attack, I attack, they counter, and then I counter their counter and so on. And we put together this, you know, this fight, which would be one phrase of, I usually like fights to have about five phrases or so. I did a Justified where I used Christian Kane. Leverage, where I used Christian Kane. He had me come in because we'd worked together on Second Hand Lions. He was playing the young Robert Duvall. And, we put together a fight sequence in a kitchen in about 45 minutes. And it was a five-phrase fight, which not a lot of actors can do. We shot it as a master every time. We didn't shoot it in pieces. And, you know, I was very proud of Christian. He's very, very capable and very good actor. And, we were able to do that because he knew me and trusted me. And, you know, we basically created a story. And the moves that we did, you know, told that story. That's how I remember choreography. I tell a story. And to me, if the audience can't follow the narrative of the story, then they can't really get, you know, emotionally involved and invested in the character. So that's the choices I make are based on their actor choices. You know, so the choreography that I make are director-actor choices, you know, they're to tell the audience a story. And that I think is more satisfying. That's how I like to work. But yeah, it's you give me a tool and I'll turn it into a story opportunity for you.
Wonderful. Are we doing all right with time with you, sir?
Well, it's 7:10. I think we've been at this about an hour and 10 minutes. You got
we've been on.
A couple more questions, then I kind of need to go.
Yeah.
But Doug, you can have back.
Do what now?
You Doug. Can have back.
Yeah.
Yeah, we can always have a sequel. That's you, fine.
Hey there.
Okay, hey, so we do have a couple questions from the YouTube chat room. So I want to throw some of these at you real quick before you take off. You said that the God Skeletor outfit was hard to wear, and you also said the blade suit was very heavy. Which one was worse?
Blade was difficult because it was physically exhausting to wear, but then I was getting to play Blade, so you know it worked out. I went, okay, this is the price. I'm okay with it. So I'll make sure I drink a lot of water and pour, you know, and make sure my suit airs out between days. You know, it was, we would take the shoulder pads and the chainmail off whenever we could, because again, I don't know how much, you know, it was at least 50 pounds, you know, maybe more. They never would tell me, but it was very, very heavy. And I'm over in a corner doing ballet exercises to save my knees because it all the movement that I'm doing with, well, it's basically like carrying a small devious child on my shoulder all day. So that was the difficulty of that. But, you know, again, I had a great character, so I went, yeah, okay. The Skeletor outfit, well, especially the God Skeletor, was difficult because I couldn't see, and my footing was terrible. It was like literally being on a sheet of ice, but I couldn't look down at the stairs to see without turning my whole head and looking down. And then I was a little top heavy. I was a bit like a Vegas showgirl. So that was the difficulty with that. And I was disappointed that, because we'd come up with some really nice choreography the day before, but as soon as they went, no, we were incorrect. This is after the transformation, so you're going to be in this outfit. And I just turned to Walter and said, well, all that stuff that you liked yesterday, we can't do 60% of it. So give me a minute and I'll come up with something else. So that it was mostly a matter of disappointment that there wasn't time to do something brand new with these new limitations.
All right. So next question, did directing Blood Trail and Blood Trail 2 change the way you looked at acting?
Nope. No. I've always been a storyteller. As an actor, I'm a storyteller. As a director, I'm a storyteller. As a choreographer, I'm a storyteller. And then I was, you know, screenwriter on that, co-screenwriter on one, and then screenwriter on the other one. I just did a new film called Duke that is an homage to John Wayne, and it's an end-of-life story that's very lovely. It's actually up on the John Wayne fan club this month, so people can look at it for free. And that was an, you know, it's another case of I'm trying to tell a story, and I'm trying to make it as human and accessible and recognizable as possible, and then also you know, keep it entertaining. And where I can, I try to utilize action to give me another tool with which to tell the story. So, you know, and I love the Western genre, so we were using my horses and my locations and, you know, my story ideas with my partner, and, you know, and I called in friends to put it all together. But ultimately, it was all about trying to tell an entertaining story.
Okay. Now, earlier in the show, you said that you get better or you get older. What are some of the techniques you use to push yourself forward? Anything like goal setting or visualization? And what's your current training technique look like?
What I actually said was, this is my little t-shirt mantra. So if you put it on a shirt, you got to give me, I get a cut. No, I just said, if I'm not getting better, I'm just getting older. And there's only one of those I can do anything about. So I'm always trying to continue to get better. There are some things, there are some physical things I don't do jumping spinning kicks anymore. But at the same time, my precision and my accuracy and my finesse is much better than it's ever been, and hopefully will continue to be so. I continue to train in different arts. I continue to teach. I find one of the things that keeps me performance sharp is teaching, is sharing my knowledge with other people. I like to share my knowledge with people who are interested and are going to do something with it. Sometimes I get paid very well because I'll come on a set and I'm working with, you know, quite often big name actors to, as I said, help them maximize their character driven action opportunities, because that's how I view it. Sometimes it's people coming to train with me at the ranch. Everybody gets the same amount of commitment. It's just when I'm getting paid by studios, I get paid better. But so I'm, you know, and then we have a very nice lifestyle. Here at the ranch is where my school is, so people come here to train, and I'm probably teaching and training people, you know, 2 to 4 days a week, and then I'm training myself, you know, 2 or 3 days a week. And then I've got things like, it was my dream to ride horses as a boy. I didn't come to it till my late 30s. It's now been some 24, 25 years later. I've been on horseback in 11 countries on 5 continents. Because I wanted to put my weapon skills onto horseback. And I went, I've got to become a much better horse person, because you have to be a good rider and you have to be good with weapons before you can think about putting the two together. Because your horse does your footwork for you, but he's moving somewhere between 15 and 25 to 30 miles an hour. And you have all of that power. And then, of course, you have to win his trust and the accuracy. But I can take it to, it's actually on my website. If you go to delonges.com, you'll see me take a target out of my partner's hands as we pass at full gallop, and I cut a target out of his hand with the whip. And we made that up as something to do, you know, on the set of more extreme marksmen, just because, well, I know I can do it. We just have to persuade the horses it's a good idea. But by then, the horses trusted me so much that we, you know, we did it a couple of times. They went, oh, that's what we're doing? Yeah, all right. And so we did. I thought, this is going to be a hard shot because my buddy's starting down there and I'm starting over here to get us up to speed, and the camera's in the middle, and we have to do this and not hit the horses and not hit each other, you know, and do it underneath the camera. We did it four times in a row. And we just went, okay, well, we're putting this in the live act now. But I like to be able to train to actually be able to do something. So then it's easy to film. I've thrown knives at, you know, and axes on set around actors. But that's a lot of responsibility. You know, you have to train to that level. So, and I enjoy it. So, yes, I'm always trying to, the point of all this is, knowledge is power. You know, knowledge is choices, and your art is in your choices. And if you continue to train yourself, you give yourself more options so that when a situation comes up, you know, like the thing with Michelle, we were able to create something. Or when I'm on a set, I can look at something and go, well, how about if we do this? You know, you come in with a plan, but you get there and you have the skill and the intuition to look at a situation and go, you know, we could do this. It'll be even better and cheaper, which that usually catches their interest. So that's why I do what I do.
All right. So two final questions I'm going to ask you. One, several people have asked this. Do you have your own Blade action figure?
I do now. I had this horrible thing that they came up with initially, which sort of had a melted face and this generic twisty body, you know, that they stuck a couple of funky weapons in, and they were saying, and here's the Blade doll. And I'm going, yes, and it doesn't look a thing like me, so you're not going to pay me anything, are you? that me going, it doesn't look a thing like me. And then, I don't know, a year or so ago, you know, some of the fans came to me and said, you know, they're going to put out this classic thing, and we're trying to generate enough interest in, you know, the community to persuade Mattel to come out with this classic toy line, a character about Blade. So, I did a little video for them and said, you know, this is Blade. I'm masquerading as a sword master, you know, in Agua Dulce and his Rancho and Dalo, and you know, don't let this be my legacy, you know, vote for the new action figure, you know, for Blade. So they created the new action figure. I still don't get any money, but you know, at least it's a lot closer to the character.
That was a great video. I watched that video. I was very thrilled to see that when you released that.
Well, you know, if you're pitching me for the new movie, I'll make you a video.
Oh, no, I mean, I'll do whatever I got to. And I'll push it to the moon to make sure you're a part of the new movie. And well, not thanks, just buddy. Behind the camera, in front of it, too.
That would be great. Yeah, I would like to be in front, but I'll come in and help wherever I can. But yeah, also tell people about training at the ranch, because we get professionals from around the country and over the world. I keep my school here so that people come to me. So because a lot of people do come to me, but I've always got something to do. So, you know, you have to change your plans. No problem. I'm busy. But I also don't mind training people who are just interested, you know. And so we do, you know, an action training, you know, action vacation for people. And I like teaching because you teach me how to teach you. I don't teach everybody the same. As a matter of fact, I teach almost everybody a little bit differently because depending on what you know, what your skills already are, or what your experience is, or what you want, or I will find, if I know something and you want to know it, I'll find a way to teach it to you. And which means I'm constantly rediscovering stuff I've known for decades, but at a slightly different level or a slightly different perspective. And that just deepens my knowledge. And I have a really good time, watching the light bulbs go off.
That sounds like a blast, because that would be me, the whole action vacation thing. That it's very interesting to me, and it would be...
Drop me an email. I'll send you information.
Absolutely. To be trained by Blade, what could be better than that?
Well, I have a friend who comes in from Paris, and he showed up with a shirt this last year that it says, "Trained by Blade, you have no chance." Which I thought was very good. His name is Circe Silva Wolf. You may see him online. Something. That's a super gay, of course, but he's an ex-gendarme and a very nice fellow. And he's been out here every year for the last 3 years. So we enjoy. So I can teach what I know in English and in French and in Spanish.
Wow.
All right. Final question directly from YouTube. Someone wants to know, can we get any information about 1066?
That's a great question. I have heard nothing. Recently, I was contacted by the producers. I still lived in Hollywood, and that was 14 years ago. So it is a project that I think is, it's certainly a very exciting story. I learned about it at school, and they had asked me to come on board as a fight coordinator. And I haven't heard too much about it in the last couple of years, so I'm not sure. But I would certainly love to hear more.
All right, that's going to do it from here, guys. Back to you.
All right. Well, Anthony, I guess before we let you go, any interest in coming back for a second interview by chance?
Sure. Just
because
figure out what you want to talk about.
I've got 2 pages of questions here. I barely scratched the surface, honestly, and I have no idea what else Joe had in mind.
Okay. Probably talk to me about next month, June or July. We can work something out.
Fantastic. Well, you heard it here, people. Blade will return to Fans of Power. So
I'll be back.
Well, that's awesome. Well,
thanks, guys, and best to all the fans, and I appreciate you reaching out.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your time.
All right. Good night.
Thanks for joining us. Good night.
Later.